Well, today, I thought the story of Esther could be a great encouragement to our mothers this morning. Again, you know, thinking of our mothers in all different ways. Grandmothers, great-grandmothers, biological, adoptive, spiritual mothers. All types of mothering is so important and crucial. And so I went on the website just kind of thinking through what to preach on, and I noticed we didn't have a sermon on the book of Esther, and I thought, well, that's a huge deficit in our website. It needs to be represented. It's such an inspiring and reassuring and motivating story. So mothers, through Esther, you see that God is at work. I mean, he really is at work. And God is using you, and he really is. Two incredibly important truths. So I want to tell her story and then draw out some points for us. And some of us know and love the story of Esther, largely through the VeggieTales version. And that's okay. It is a delightful story. We love it too. We're going to go a little bit deeper this morning. So let's read. This is the pivotal chapter in the book of Esther, chapter 4. It's a great, remarkable chapter. Let's read God's word, chapter 4, verse 1. When Mordecai learned all that had been done, Mordecai tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city. And he cried out with a loud and bitter cry. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one was allowed to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. And in every province, wherever the king's command and his decree reached, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's young women and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called for Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs who had been appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was. Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her and command her to go to the king to beg his favor and plead with him on behalf of her people. And Hathach went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and commanded him to go to Mordecai and say, look, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law: to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the gold scepter so that he may live. But as for me, I have not been called to come into the king these 30 days. And they told Mordecai what Esther had said. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, release and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf and do not eat or drink for three days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast as you do, then I will go to the king. Though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. And the grass withers and the flowers fade, And this is a good story, and it endures forever. Thanks be to God. Well, this is all real history, and it's a hard history. God's people are in exile. It's about the year 483 BC. So recall that God has severely disciplined his chosen people. For years, he had warned them it was coming. He warned them it was coming because of their idolatrous worship, their polluted ways, things like their pride and their injustice to one another, their immorality. Finally, true to his word, God sends the Assyrians against the northern kingdom of Israel in 722 BC. Then later, God sends, when it doesn't affect the southern kingdom, God sends the Babylonians, remember King Nebuchadnezzar, against the southern kingdom in 586 BC. So the Babylonians burn God's temple to the ground, raise Jerusalem, slaughter many, kill the king, and deport others to Babylon. So Psalm 137, you know, he tells the heart of the people, they're devastated, you know, away from the temple and away from the land. Like the glory cloud even departed from Jerusalem. And they're asked to sing the songs of Zion by their captors. They say, how can we sing? You know, by the rivers of Babylon, we sat and we wept, remembering Zion, devastating. So Esther and her uncle, her adoptive father, Mordecai, they descend from this group that's come from Judah in Jerusalem, the southern kingdom, in 586. There are several generations later. So the Jews settle in Babylon. Before this had ever happened, Jeremiah had warned them and had instructed them what to do in exile. And he said, build houses, plant gardens, marry and have families, pray and seek the welfare of the city. Really? The welfare of the city? Well, we're in exile? So that's what the exiles do. 586, go to Babylon, seeking the welfare of their city. They settle in, they make a life for themselves. And on the whole, the culture is tolerant of them. Many of them succeed. You think of Daniel and his friends, the upper echelons of government under Nebuchadnezzar and those that come after him. You think of their gospel influence. But with Daniel and his friends, you also know that things can turn on a dime. One can be thrown into the furnace for refusing to worship the king. One can be thrown into a den of lions for praying to the living and true God. These were totalitarian, oppressive, and pagan cultures. This is hard. Okay, well, in 539 BC, all right, now we're at 539. Sorry for the dates. About 7 years have gone by, as the prophet said. 539, another king comes to the throne, but this one is a Persian king, and he runs over Babylon, destroys Babylon. God had prophesied this through Isaiah years before, talking about Cyrus the Persian rising up and destroying those that persecuted his people. And so Cyrus had built this powerful, wealthy kingdom. It was the largest empire in history at that time. That's what God's people are caught up in. And so he overruns Babylon without a problem, incorporates them into his empire. And if you remember, Cyrus was this enlightened leader. He was different than Nebuchadnezzar because he encouraged exiled people to return home, to rebuild their cities and their temples, and to worship their gods again. You see, Cyrus wanted to get the favor of all the gods, the more the better. And so he wanted people to go home and build their temples back. So if you recall, he issues an edict permitting the Jews, the exiles, to return home to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple and Jerusalem, 539. Okay, so therefore, many of those Jews in exile, now in the Persian kingdom, many of the more zealous and enthusiastic Jews, the "as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord," there's our stake in the ground, We have a vision for God restoring Israel. Those types, they left the stability and comfort of Babylon, the Persian kingdom now, and they migrated back to Judah to undertake the rebuilding of their nation, which means a good number of those that remained behind were probably comfortable and stable where they were. Well, two other kings come to power. The empire continues to grow, and the capital of the kingdom changes from Babylon to this massive new city, this incredible building project that the Persians undertook to build the city of Susa. And that's where Esther's story unfolds, in the new capital of the greatest and most powerful kingdom on earth that now ranges from India all the way to Ethiopia. I mean, it's a tremendous, powerful, dominant kingdom. And she's among those who stay back in the Persian kingdom, maybe too comfortable, and didn't go back to Palestine. So the king Xerxes at this point, Ahasuerus. I've got like three pronunciations of this name going on in my head, so I will say Ahasuerus. Again, it's 483 BC, and the book of Esther opens up with Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, hosting this elaborate party. If you remember in your reading, it's a 180-day party. 106-month party. He's invited all the richest and most powerful people to his palace in Susa, the citadel of Susa. Nobles and governors and officials and servants and military leaders from all over the 127 provinces of his empire that ranges from India to Ethiopia. They're all there. The lifestyles are rich and famous. And it seems the goal is that he wants to prove how wealthy he is. And he wants to garner support for his upcoming expansion goals into Greece. And he spares no expense. It's just opulent and decadent. Like, it's over the top, the way it's described. He's all about appearances. The kingdom is about appearances. One commentator, Duguid, says it this way: we're supposed to be both impressed and revolted by it. We're supposed to ask, who could be a greater king than Ahasuerus? Huh? Or what kind of king is Ahasuerus? Well, to culminate his 180-day party, Ahasuerus holds a 7-day party intensive. If it wasn't good enough already, they're going to end with a bang. So it's all the gluttony and drinking and entertainment his guests could ever want. Well, on the 7th and final day, this is the kickoff. When he and his guests are good and 3 sheets to the wind, he decides to send for his wife, Queen Vashti. And she's a very attractive woman. She's known for her attractiveness. He sends for her in order to show off her beauty to all his guests. His goal is to display his greatness by putting his trophy wife on display as a sex object. And it's a sordid thing. She'd be barely dressed before a bunch of drunk men. Well, to the utter shock of everyone, after he sends for her and to Ahasuerus himself, Queen Vashti says, "Absolutely not. I am not doing that." Can you do that? It's utter shock to everybody. A tremor goes through the guests and the party. She actually resists the will of the king and the kingdom. And so Ahasuerus gets outraged. He strips Vashti of her title as queen. He sends her away, never to appear again. That's the kind of thing that happens when someone stands up to the empire. Well, soon afterwards, Ahasuerus determines he needs a new queen. So they devise a plan to send officers to all the provinces, the 127 provinces, of the whole empire to gather up beautiful women for his harem. It's kind of a forced beauty contest, conscripting ladies for the harem. Everyone lives to serve the kingdom. And so in chapter 2, we meet Mordecai, and we meet his young niece, Esther. They're caught up in this. Esther is from a defeated, exiled people. She's an orphan. She has neither father nor mother. Mordecai, her uncle, has become her adoptive father. Esther is known for being very beautiful, lovely to look at. Therefore, when those officials reach where she is, they immediately recruit her or conscript her for the beauty pageant. They take her to be a part of the harem. And it doesn't seem like she resists, nor anybody resists, because that's just life in the kingdom. You just got to accept it. But it's more. When Esther gets to the palace, to the harem, she pleases the man in charge and wins his favor. Wins his favor. Ian Duguid again says, "Win favor is an unusual idiom. It carries the sense that she worked for her promotion in the House of Women by fitting into the agenda that the empire set for her." What he's saying is she throws herself full throttle into the 12-month-long beauty regimen assigned to her, all the cosmetics they give her, all the food they want her to eat, and she doesn't just win the favor of the man in charge. It goes on to say she wins the favor of everyone. And then when it's her turn after 12 months to appear before the king, she wins the king's favor. You get this idea that Esther is fully immersed in what's going on. She isn't just an exile seeking the welfare of Susa. She's been assimilated into the mindset of Susa. She's trying to excel and be the best. What the empire tells her is life, the way to live. She's both a victim and a participant. But this is made even clearer and actually more grave in the way that Mordecai speaks to her when she goes to the harem. Mordecai looks at her and says, "Don't make known your people or your kindred." That's to say, Esther, don't tell them you're a Jew. Hide from them that you're a member of God's chosen people, that you worship the Lord, that that's who you really are. Hide that from them. At this point, both Esther and Mordecai are suppressing their true identity as people of God's kingdom in order to survive and thrive in Ahasuerus's kingdom. So Ahasuerus makes Esther, who's kind of this anti-Vashti at this point, she's both beautiful, but she's compliant, he makes her queen. And it seems that she is queen for some 5 years, continuing to win the favor of all and be the favorite wife of the king. Okay, well, then one day, Mordecai, who's a low-ranking government official, Mordecai one day is at the gate to get some news about Esther. And while Mordecai is at the king's gate, he happens to overhear a plot to assassinate Ahasuerus. And so Mordecai tells Esther, and Esther passes it on to the king. And the king discovers it, that it is actually true, and so he executes the two assassins. And Mordecai's deed is recorded in the king's records, but though kings are usually pretty good about honoring those who benefit the kingdom, the king, it just so happens, forgets to honor Mordecai. Well, then later, Ahasuerus promotes this despicable man, Haman. He promotes him to the role of chief advisor to the king, a kind of prime minister position. And Haman is this especially vain and ambitious man. The king commands, probably at Haman's suggestion, that all the servants of the palace bow down before him. All right, Mordecai can't tolerate that. Mordecai refuses, and not just once, but day after day when he comes to the gates, he will not bow down to Mordecai. His reasons are pretty complex. We don't have the time to go into it, but in any event, Mordecai, who's been living this compromised life, really, having an inner faith but not outwardly known or governing his mindset, who's been concealing who he is, Mordecai makes a stand. And he reveals that he is a Jew and explains why he can't bow. But Haman can't tolerate his disrespect, and he boils over with anger. And it's not enough in his anger to just eliminate Mordecai. He's a man that goes over the top like his king. He goes, I'm not just going to deal with Mordecai. I'm going to erase all of the Jews. And so he goes to Ahasuerus. He slanders the Jews, plants untruths, and then he bribes him with 10,000 talents of silver. Y'all, that's 750,000 pounds of silver. I want you to do this. So the king, without really looking into it, probably the money was looking very good, he seals and sends out an edict instructing everyone in the empire to destroy, to kill, to annihilate all the Jews and to plunder the goods. It's a massacre. And that leads us to chapter 4. That's the setting. That's what's going on. It's a grave, acute, imminent threat. And Mordecai hears what has happened. Mordecai actually gets a copy of the edict. He immediately tears his clothes. He puts on sackcloth and ashes. He cries out with a loud and bitter cry, and he goes to the king's gate. And the way Mordecai reacts to the news is the way Jews throughout the empire are reacting. It's devastating. Within a week or two, they're going to be done for. Done for. So Esther's servants realize that Mordecai is at the gates. They rush to Esther and they say, Esther, you know, this is what Mordecai is doing. He's crying. He's in sackcloth and ashes. He's at the king gate. We don't know what he's talking about. And Esther gets deeply distressed about him. So she sends him clothes, but he refuses to change his clothes. So then she sends out Hathach, a higher level official, to discover what's the deal with Mordecai. And again, it's so telling. Like, Esther has hidden her identity so well, and she's so insulated in the luxury and lifestyle, the king's harem, that she's completely out of touch with what's going on with her people. She's lost touch with the covenant people of God. She has no clue about the imminent danger before them. Well, then furthermore, Mordecai relays the tragic news to her and begs her to plead with the king. But her response to him is a little ambivalent. She reminds Mordecai, you know, you're a government official, Mordecai. You know the risk you're putting me in. Mordecai, you know that no one can appear before the king without a summons. It means death. That's the norm, unless he extends the golden scepter to you. And Mordecai, it's not looking very good for me right now. Like, I haven't even gone to see him in 30 days. Evidently, there's some other women that he's seeing, not me. Mordecai, remember, bad things happen to insubordinate queens. Would you remember Vashti? But Mordecai is undeterred and insists with these famous words. Do you think, Esther, to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews? For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? And to this, Esther comes to her senses. And she comes to her senses and realizes, I can keep hiding. I can abandon my people. I could likely die anyway. Or I can risk it all with an implicit faith in God and just maybe be used to turn the heart of the king. Just maybe. So this natural, compliant, going along with the culture girl rises to the occasion and makes a hard decision, a tremendous faith step. Mordecai, tell the other Jews in Susa to fast for me for 3 days. I and my servant girls will fast also. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and I am scared stiff. And if I perish, I perish. Those are some powerful words. And so we know what happens. Esther proves herself to be not just a beauty, but also bold and courageous to go to the king. And furthermore, wise and tactful in dealing with him. She appears before him once again, wins his favor, but now for a noble purpose. He extends his golden scepter. He asks what she wants. He promises her half of his kingdom. And she invites him and Haman to a feast that she's prepared for them. And they have a wonderful time. And the king looks at her and says, well, what do you want? Again, up to half my kingdom. And she responds by inviting him to another feast the next day. She's building her relationship where she will promise to tell him what she wants. And the king agrees. And Haman goes home on cloud 9. I mean, he has made it, he thinks. But on the way, he sees Mordecai and gets furious again. So when he gets home, his wife and his advisors counsel him. Okay, Mordecai, just build a 75-foot gallows. Tell the king to hang him in the morning and then go off and enjoy your feast. But that night, it just so happens that the king can't sleep. And it just so happens he runs across how Mordecai had saved him. So the next morning, when Haman comes to talk to him about hanging Mordecai, he tells Haman to go honor Mordecai, whom he now calls Mordecai the Jew. So Haman leads Mordecai, appalled Haman, leads Mordecai out with the royal robes on the king's horse, and with a crown. And terror begins to rise within Mordecai as he sees that his plan to destroy the Jews is about to come crashing down on him. And sure enough, soon afterward, the feast, the king and Esther and Haman, the king looks at Esther again and says, what do you want? Up to half my kingdom, Esther. And Esther throws caution to the wind. She risks it all. She reveals her identity. She comes clean as a God-fearing people of God. And she says, please save me and my people from being destroyed and killed and annihilated. And the king responds, who dares to treat you and your people this way? And Esther looks and says, a foe and enemy, this wicked Haman. And the king rises, boiling over in wrath. Who dares to destroy my favorite wife? Who dares to destroy a man who rescued me? And the king sentences Haman to be hung on the very gallows he built for Mordecai, poetic justice. When the story continues, the king sides with the Jews and they are saved. But what are some things we learn here? Some deep bedrock, reassuring, motivating truths that we can plant our stake in the ground on. I have four. It's pretty quick. First, God is at work. And God is at work when we don't feel like he's at work and we don't see him at work. He is sovereignly and graciously working. And he does so often in hidden and secret and invisible and unperceived ways. And this comes out so strongly in Esther because Esther is the only book in all of Scripture, the only book in the whole Bible in which the name of God is not even used. Like, God is not mentioned or referenced at all. At no point does anyone speak of the Lord. At no point does the Lord explicitly speak. Now, he's implied throughout the actions of fasting and putting on sackcloth and ashes and crying out implies the Lord's hand. And he's the great presupposition behind Mordecai saying to Esther, you know, deliverance is going to come whether you work or not, but maybe you've been raised up for such a time as this. Mordecai has one plan. He doesn't have a plan B. It banks on God working. However, God is never center stage, and he's always behind the scenes. Yet at the same time, he's the real actor throughout. It's his story, not Ahasuerus's. He coordinates everything, even the weakness and worldliness of Esther. The overhearing of Mordecai and the insomnia of the king in order to overrule King Ahasuerus' power with his own power and purpose. And we're supposed to laugh at that when we feel overwhelmed by the circumstances around us that are so big. We see God overruling the one who is the most powerful man on earth. God is the true king, working mysteriously for his saving good in the lives of his covenant people. This story is Romans 8:28, and we know that all things, God works for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purpose. It seems the main reason for not specifically mentioning God is to impress us. Mothers, to impress you with the truth that he really is working even when you don't feel like it or notice it or see it all the time. We need to be encouraged by the gracious, overruling, sovereign working of God. And second, God really does use you in his amazing saving plan. He does. Mothers, he uses you far beyond what you can imagine. Could you ever imagine Esther ever thinking God would use her in that way? Where you are and what you're doing is for such a time as this. And all the errands you run and carpools you undertake and meals you cook and caring for people, that is your such a time as this. You think, well, like, who am I? Like, I'm nobody special. In fact, I can see so many flaws, so much weakness, so much worldliness. I'm just trying to make it in this big, powerful world system. Well, God raises up Esther. He wants you to see that. She's an exile. She's an orphan. She's compliant. She's conformed to the world. She's a beauty queen. She's eating all the food. She's doing her beauty treatment. She's playing the game and at least outwardly denying she's a believer. She certainly, we don't look at her and say she's a Daniel. We don't say dare to be a Daniel over Esther. But in any event, God is arranging all of it. And when he puts her in a tough situation in which she has to decide who she is, he enables her to identify herself with the living and true God and with his people. And he reveals their little story with all its foibles, with all its being sinned against, and sinning is part of God's big saving story. She's an unlikely hero. And mothers and all of us were unlikely heroes. Paul says, God delights to use the weak things in the world to shame the strong. You see your weakness, he delights to use you. And he tends to put us in tough situations. Maybe they're acute. Maybe it's just the daily grind. We have to dig down and say, who am I? Who do I belong to? What do I believe? If he uses Esther, he can use us. Third, the way God tends to work is through us as we lay down our lives for others. Tim Keller says it beautifully. We've got to be willing to lose the palace, to lose our status, really to lose our lives. That's how God works. It's little people laying down their lives for the good of others, for love towards others. Jesus would say the same thing. We save our lives by losing our lives. And when do we ever see this modeled better than in godly mothers who lay down their lives for others? And fourth and finally, this way of working is really because Esther anticipates the most unlikely hero of all. You see, Jesus is the one who truly left the palace. Jesus is the one who sacrificed his status. He gave up his life. God the Son becomes a nobody in Jesus of Nazareth. He didn't just risk his life, he came to expressly give it for us. And so the prince of darkness raged against him, the evil one. And then the great forces of the world condemned him, the Jewish leadership and the whole Roman Empire. You don't challenge Rome. And he was crucified outside the city gate on a trash heap. And he was made to be refuse. And he appeared that he was nothing. But see, God was sovereignly and graciously working for the good of his covenant people through this. And God was using his beloved son. And in that event, God made him to be our sin. And God judged him in our place for sin so that we could be forgiven and declared righteous. Like, in the work of Jesus and his intervention on our behalf, the true king now extends the golden scepter to us and accepts us and welcomes us always into his throne room. And this is that glorious mystery of the gospel. And little Queen Esther had the beautiful role of pointing us to that. Would she have ever imagined that in her wildest dreams? It's the amazing grace of the gospel that God uses unlikely people because Jesus is the true unlikely hero. And this is that gospel which daily refreshes you mothers, all of us, and the gospel that we get the opportunity to reflect a little as we labor behind the scenes, caring for others, all for Jesus's, God's glory and extension of the gospel of grace. Our very Redeemer is an unlikely hero, the living and true God who goes down to the lowest place to lift us back up to him, to open up the kingdom, and for the Father to extend us the scepter, and for us not just to be admitted for a moment, but welcomed forever. That's what you've got. May God add his blessing. Amen. Let's stand.